Hey, folks, welcome back to the podcast. Today is January 17th, and this is a supplemental show. It's actually a portion of an interview that I recorded a couple weeks ago for a program called The Ed and Ethan Show, which you can find on the Liberty Radio Network, and I highly recommend it. I really like these guys. I hadn't listened before, but I've listened a couple times since, and super high-quality show. I'll tell you what, I'm sorry I ruined it for them. And here's what I mean, and I debated not posting this, but I thought it was such a cool conversation that I decided, you should have the option of hearing it if you want. How did you ruin it, Brett? Well, okay. Their show sounds great. They have some very nice professional radio microphones. I was so excited because it was the first time I was going to use the mic I'm talking to you on right now, the Shure mic that I bought. I had gone to a storage unit that I had to get my mixer out and set it up just for this occasion. I installed a new Skype recorder, and either plugging in the mixer or asking the Skype recorder to communicate with Skype sent the microphone used to record back to the default setting, which is a built-in mic on a laptop, and they're never good. So throughout this entire interview, it sounds like I'm on an old telephone, maybe a payphone, maybe a phone at a bowling alley. I don't know. I called the bowling alley tonight. The audio quality was terrible on their end. So I'm working on this show on zero tolerance, and I'm finding it difficult because it's kind of a frustrating subject to strike a constructive tone. So if you just heard the series that we wrapped up with Daryl, getting great reviews, by the way, people really like it, and I'm so pleased to hear that. I thought this would be a nice review of some of the things we covered before we moved on to, like I said, a little bit more of a frustrating subject. So this is just a portion of my discussion with Ed and Ethan. We also did an after show because we ran out of time for their format.
Also, you might hear me open with a statement similar to people should be able to understand the ideas of liberty if they're smart enough to make ice cubes and not fall in volcanoes. And you might be thinking, that's kind of a mean thing to say. Totally came out wrong. What I was trying to say is that the ideas that we're trying to project are so simple, they should be understandable to anybody who can, you know, make the cubes, avoid the volcanoes. But it turns a question back on us. Why are we not successful in communicating these ideas? And what can we do differently? That's kind of what I meant. Also, I've gotten a couple comments on older shows recently, and I wanted to just take a minute to share a couple of them with you. I'm happy to know that people are discovering the old shows, listening to the old shows, and they're finding them helpful. And I'm sorry, they sound awful. So thank you, everyone, for persevering through that stuff. All right, so the first comment is on episode 74, which sounds fine. It was called Police State Pupils, Acquiescence, and Aggression. And this was an episode from December 2010. And it was about how zero tolerance policies are helping to prepare kids for a police state in the adult society. And the user's name was Maya. I know I am 3 years late, but 8 minutes into this podcast, my 11-year-old daughter, who is in the sixth grade, casually proclaimed from her chair behind me, quote, "If you bring a cough drop to school, you get lunch detention." I ranted for a few minutes, but I am happy to know the next school year, both my children will be educated at home by their own interests and with my assistance in finding them resources. Thank you for the work you do, Brett. You are welcome, and I'm so happy to hear that you're going to be doing that, and that stories in these old shows help people realize they're not isolated in this world of the adults who are supervising their children behaving like strange robots. And the other comment comes from an even older show, episode 26, which was called American Idol Worship. It was about the Pledge of Allegiance. Same user. In one of your older podcasts I recently listened to for the first time from your American History F series, you asked for a high school student's story of how not standing up in order to pledge allegiance to the flag was received by the school's authority figures. Previous to knowing of your work, I had shared with my two children, who are 9 and 11 years old, how as a junior in high school, I boycotted the pledge. My English teacher tried to admonish and humiliate me, but I argued atheism and not liking the God terminology, and she decided to shut up and leave me alone. My daughter, who is 11, loved the idea, and of her own volition, on the fourth day of sixth grade, decided to test this theory. I was unaware of this happening until after the fact. The story ensues as follows. The school my children attend is a public school. My daughter's sixth grade is contained in middle school. The pledge is announced first thing during homeroom. Her homeroom teacher is also her math teacher. When the pledge was announced this day, my daughter opted to remain in her seat. According to my daughter, the teacher gave her a funny glance because she happened to be seated directly beneath the flag. The child also happened to be seated right next to the doorway. This allowed a teacher's aide to witness my daughter's nonconformity, and upon seeing that, decided to rush into the classroom and physically grab her arm and force her to stand up. The aide then asked my daughter her name, which she answered, and in reply, the aide said, "Oh, I know you." The statement baffled me a little, since I am aware of knowing exactly zero people who work as a teacher's aide. The aide then threatened my daughter with being sent to the principal's office. When my daughter arrived home that day, she relayed this story to me. The rest of that day and the next day was spent being ridiculed and harassed by the aide. The harassment increased in a juvenile fashion after I had sent a note to the homeroom teacher asking her to work out a win-win solution with my daughter and to please ask the aide to refrain from placing her hands on my child in order to force her to stand up. The teacher responded graciously to my note, phoning in the afternoon and thanking me for letting her know where my daughter was coming from, and the two of them were able to work out a solution. Great. The aide, on the other hand, spent 2 days bullying my child, telling her she was disrespectful, scary, and generally giving her a hard time. My husband and I were so shocked by the aide's reaction that he decided to broach the subject with coworkers and friends. Some coworkers were respectful of children's will, but most were aghast at the thought of a child being disrespectful. He also decided to ask a couple we have known for 2 decades their thoughts on a student not wanting to say the pledge. The wife is a high school physics teacher. They are both naturally loud people. The question somehow increased her volume, and she vehemently opposed any child being so disrespectful to not want to stand to say the pledge. She proudly exclaimed, "I will force them to stand." Her official reasoning for being so angry about such a lack of respect was this: "It's in the handbook." This conversation was very distressing to this woman, so much so that she visibly sat quietly and recomposed herself for a few minutes. I felt bad for her. However, my respect for this woman diminished greatly. Her husband also got angry and shouted at my husband and myself, "It's disrespectful, like wearing a hat at a funeral." The first statement was clearly a knee-jerk reaction, but the latter was just plain weird. Clearly this man has heard of fedoras and women who wear hats with veils on them to funerals, has he not? Also, while writing this letter to you, I've been playing online poker. During this time, I have posed the question to poker players at my tables who come from all over the world. How many Americans get angry when somebody does not stand up to say the Pledge of Allegiance? Not surprisingly, most Americans respond, "I do." But when I ask the question with a "why," their immediate response is, "It's disrespectful, and if you don't like it, you can leave." This is my family story regarding the Pledge of Allegiance, and I'm very proud to know my 11-year-old daughter has better thought processes than most online poker players and teacher's aides. Those were written by Maya. Thank you so much. Those comments made my day. And obviously, it's sad when things like this happen to a youngster, but I felt like both of those messages concluded in a really positive and optimistic way. And I'm glad the old shows are helpful. And the reason why I decided to include those is the very next installment of School Sucks podcast is going to deal with these themes in great detail, right? Detentions over cough drops and thoughtless demands from adults in the schools and beyond. That's what we're going to be getting into. So stay tuned. That'll be it's a day away. And on a final note, I was lying in bed this morning and this thought popped into my head. I said, "Ooh, wouldn't it be nice to double or triple the size of the audience of School Sucks podcast?" Sure, it would. Sure, it would. It would be wonderful to do that. Well, how do you do that? You get on shows that have bigger audiences. So there are certainly a lot of YouTube people who have much larger audiences than School Sucks Podcast, but I'm trying to think of people who are speaking the same language. All the audiences bigger than ours, we've done a lot of them, you know, that come to mind, like Free Domain Radio, Tragedy and Hope, been on there a lot, Gnostic Media. So, you know, I'm thinking Alex Jones, James Corbett, Joe Rogan. And recently on the Joe Rogan front, I'm a huge Joe Rogan fan, by the way. I love that guy. I think he's great. He did an interview with Brian Dunning, a man who calls himself a skeptic. It was a very, very frustrating 3-hour listen. My assessment of Brian Dunning after concluding was, here's somebody who enjoyed the feelings of personal satisfaction that came from knowing a lot about a few things, so then decided that it would be fun to pretend to know a lot about everything. But he clearly does not. And it is, like I said, extraordinarily frustrating. So if you want to be frustrated, for 3 hours, I recommend listening to that episode of JRE. But I thought Rogan did a very good job and called him out on a lot of crap. So please go to the Facebook page where you can grab a link, or go to schoolsucksproject.com where you can grab a link to episode 251, Conspiracy Theorist versus Skeptics, and tweet that to @JoeRogan, and let's just see what happens. You know, that's a show that I really like to be on. I have no problem doing Alex Jones. I have no problem doing James Corbett. I'm trying to think of who else is bigger that we haven't done. There's a lot of them, but they're just not coming to mind right now. So that's the secret. You get on a bigger show. When I was first on Free Domain Radio in 2009, our audience grew from 25 people to 250. And then when Osborne got us some exposure on Free Talk Live at the end of 2009, it went from about 250 to 300 to well over 1,000, and it grew from there. So that's how you do it. We're still a relatively small show. We have a very important message. I need it to reach more people. It's dark out there, folks, and we need to project these ideas further. So that's one idea, and trust me, I'm hard at work at numerous others right now. But anyway, you know, have a super weekend. Why not? And here's a supplemental show. Enjoy.
Now, I guess we could kind of get into that. I know you're a big proponent of nonviolent communication in expressing these ideas, and me and Ethan are both fairly new to this, and we're trying to learn.
We're new to
the concept in that sense, and it's tough. You have to like relearn how you speak, essentially, almost to talk to people about these things, and. Could you kind of get into I don't know if you could kind of explain nonviolent communication and
I think it was your experience. Explain nonviolent communication, because Tim Moen, the Fort Mac philosopher that's on this show from time to time, he's a big proponent of nonviolent communication. Very productive, from what I've seen. If it's a practice skill, but Brett, what could you explain from your perspective what nonviolent communication is, and also your experiences with it?
Sure, yeah. I was probably introduced to it in 2010 by Wes Bertrand. And I like the idea. What intrigued me initially was I hadn't been very successful communicating with the people that you would think would be the most willing to hear your ideas and the most willing to embrace new ideas if a loved one was so passionate about those ideas. Like, those had been all my biggest failures, and it had meant the end of relationships, one relationship specifically that was very important to me, because I didn't have the tools to peacefully and carefully and compassionately communicate a very important message that should be, if people like evidence the kinds of critical thinking skills that allow them to put pants on and make ice cubes and not fall into volcanoes, they should be able to understand libertarianism, you know? But there's just this disconnect right? And it's incredibly frustrating when this stuff should be so easy to understand. It's the hardest thing, as Rand said one time, you know, the hardest thing to explain is what everyone has decided not to see. It's basically a paraphrase. So I reflected on my past failures, and when Wes had, you know, was really excited, and obviously, you know, I take Wes very seriously, and I said, okay, well, let's try to embrace it. And what I found was most helpful about it was it provided me a different way of speaking to myself, of having my own presence with my own thoughts and my own self-talk. And later on, this college professor from Hawaii, who's become a good friend of mine, Daryl Becker, he was able to line up the nonviolent communication process with the Trivium method of critical thinking, in that it's just another input process output model. Right, which is how computers work and how we want our minds to work for optimal functioning. So what's really going on is that you're present either with yourself or the person that you're trying to communicate with. And the first step in that is observation. You know, what's alive in me? Why am I here? Why do I want to talk to this person? Why do I want to convince them of something? What's alive in them? That's helps us develop a better understanding of feelings or motivating factors. And we're involved in communication, you know, probably to get something out of it. So ultimately it translates to an output. You know, we have a request. There's something that we want. But we shouldn't go into conversations with the expectation that somebody else will change. Because that's, you know, not very empathetic, it's not very realistic, and it's usually a good way to set yourself up for disappointment and resentment. So those are the basics, and it really, one of the things that we talked about in the recent series we did was the 4 D's of disconnected communication, which is making demands. So, you know, you need to stop doing this, and demands can be phrased in different ways, but people know when a demand is being made. The second one is diagnosis. It's people like you, right, who are ruining the world. denial of responsibility. You know, when you're confronted about something and you shift the blame or make an excuse, and deserve-oriented language. So these 4 elements that I believe Marshall Rosenberg originally identified. Is really, you know, he says that a lot of the responsibility for communication breakdown is in those 4 practices. It's trying to avoid those things and really just be more present with your own thoughts and with what's alive in another person. Those are the basics.
Sure. So, okay, Brett, listen, we're definitely right out of time here. We burnt up enough time in the first segment. But can you stick around for a bit? We can throw the rest of this up on our site at edandethan.com, and we can try, because I'd really like to stay focused on this. Can you stick around for a bit?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, perfect.
Great.
So that's everything that we've got for this week. Don't forget to check us out at edandethan.com. If you want to scream and shout at us in public, Twitter at @EdandEthanAlwaysWorks, as does feedback@edandethan.com, or hit up the FaceTubes page. We'll be back with more next week on the Liberty Express Radio Network. Stay tuned on the Liberty Express for more great content. And, of course, remember to visit the website at www.edandethan.com. We'll catch up with more with Brett here right away. If you're on our RSS feed, you're going to get this as a treat right now. So that's everything. This is Ed and Ethan. All right, so music's over.
Yeah.
All right, so let's continue, because I found this really cool. So I think this is the first time we're doing this.
Yes, this is. This is exciting. It almost reminds me of the B-list we had way back when we first started doing this on our own.
Oh, yeah. All right. So thanks for sticking around, Brett. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
So we're talking about nonviolent communication, the 4 D's. You were talking about Marshall Rosenberg. So now, I find all of this stuff really...
Yeah, this is tough, man. This is like a rewiring of my brain that needs to happen in talking to people. And I'm a very passionate person. And I get, when I'm passionate about a subject, I like, blah. And if some people like it, lots of people don't, because they get pushed away because I just kind of go overboard. And, you know, I want to just like take a plug and like plug my brain into their brain and like transfer the information so they can like really understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's hard to make people I guess, and that's another thing too, right? There's the phrasing "make people understand."
Yeah,
right?
I just did it right there. You know,
well, I did it.
Or, yeah,
but Brett, I guess this is a kind of a challenge that people run into all the time using what you might call abrasive communication, right? You get this real problem where you're running up against, you know, you're essentially resisting the person you're talking to because they're not understanding you, and they are in turn resisting you because you're trying to make them understand.
And it's tough because in the Liberty community, you want people to understand your view, and when you come off like that, it's like, it's counterproductive, and it's, you know, it's not helping at all.
Yeah, so one of the things that I've talked about a lot on the show in the past is recognizing your sphere of control, right? Which is very important, because operating outside of your sphere of control doesn't feel much like freedom, you know? Doesn't feel much like efficacy. It feels like frustration and smallness. So where is your sphere of control in the political realm? Well, you know, it's not deciding who's going to be president of the United States, you know, because I don't even think that that's decided legitimately by the people, you know. So the idea, well, I'll just, my big investment will be the Ron Paul campaign of 2016. And then when that goes down in flames, you know, if that's the basket that all your eggs were in, how does that feel? How does it feel to walk around outside the Federal Reserve with a sign that says "End the Fed"? They'll be open tomorrow. You know, they'll be open a year from now. Starting to think more about how can I have more personal liberty in my own life, and a lot of that is professional, financial, emotional, and those are the places that we should focus, right? If you have, like, this is an example. If you're addicted to heroin and you're talking about political freedom, you know, your priorities are out of order, right? Mm. You're enslaved to something else that needs more of your attention first. Mm. So that's like an extreme example of what I'm talking about. So when we take this to our interactions with other people, well, the thing that the sphere of control is our expectations for that interaction, right? So if we have these very lofty expectations that we are so smart and so right that we are going to, in the course of one conversation, make somebody else do an 180-degree turn, regardless of their age or emotional investment or other motivating factors or obstacles that might be in play for them, we are setting ourselves up for disappointment and resentment. So the only shift, I think, that can happen is our expectation. It doesn't matter. This is one of the great insights that I got from Daryl in our recent shows. Daryl Becker has a little blog called Voluntary Vision, if you want to check it out. But he said, you know, it doesn't matter what that one person is doing or thinking, right? Because when we go back to the diagnosis of, it's people like you, when, you know, yeah, it doesn't matter what you think, and sure, you should be able to believe whatever silly thing you want, but when 10 million people get together and believe the same thing, it gets people killed, it gets people jailed. Mm. Well, you know, you're in that interaction, in that conversation, you're incorporating, you know, 9,999,999 people who aren't there. Right? Mm. And that's disempowering, and that's confusing. Like, you're only talking to one person, and there really isn't that much at stake. It doesn't matter what they believe. They are statistically insignificant. And this was another insight that I got from a webmaster that I used to work with years ago. He goes, why do you care so much about what 10 people you call family think about these ideas? You understand that you could reinvest that time online and find thousands of people who are willing to hear this and are willing to embrace this and act on it. So it's really, like, I would say, just a careful evaluation and nonviolent communication with ourselves, and presence with our own thoughts and our own ambitions or goals or needs, helps us reevaluate motivations.
Okay, so here's what I think of, because when I get passionate about something, or you know, I
get hammering those keys hard.
That's right, you know, heating up the keyboard, or perhaps I've there's times at work or out in the real world there as well. I've been called a racist, bigoted, ignorant guy or something, you know, because you're butting heads with somebody, ideas that you're trying to perhaps explain and really using domineering tactics for discussion, right? Mm. And I was thinking about this, like there's I'll paraphrase Louis C.K., the stand-up comic, when he says, you know, somebody complains that you've offended them, and he says, well, okay, so you've made them in their head have a conversation. You've forced mm-hmm. them to have a think, because mm-hmm. when I think of my own experiences where I have been dominated in discussion, I've been upset not because of a logical inconsistency. I've not been upset because I'm being dominated, even though at the time I certainly thought it was that. You know, God, this guy's being such a jerk, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But what was really pissing me off was when somebody pointed out to me, for instance, you know, great, so you're all for the legalization of cannabis because it's a freedom issue to you. Why aren't you for the legalization of heroin then? This is back when I was, you know, party-driven statist boy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. when that gets pointed out to you, now, again, I think this guy's being a jerk, but that's not really what's pissing me off. What's pissing me off is that I've just been forced to have a think and been forced to see within myself a logical inconsistency. I don't think that's unproductive. I don't think I know a lot of people kind of get to the, you know, you're just causing this person to shut down. But I look at my own experiences, and yeah, I kind of shut down. I don't want to talk about this anymore. But that didn't stop me from having a think.
And you were passionate right. enough to want to learn more, too, right?
Well, maybe that's the difference. I don't know. What do you think, Brett? Give me an overview of your perspective of this, abrasive communication.
I think that what's happening and what we need to recognize, what's alive in that other person, right? And you've identified it in yourself, right? So you are, when you interact with somebody or you're discussing one of these subjects, you're jarring them out of a comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
So like the experience that I had with so many people over and over again, you know, they would interrupt, they would yell, they would get red in the face, they would start doing ad hominem attacks.
Mm.
And then they would say, I've had enough, and they would walk away. Well, that's the most basic binary choice that, you know, a living thing can make. That's fight or flight. Mm-hmm. And there's very little thought involved in that at all. And I used to be like, years ago, I would say, oh, well, that, you know, how stupid of that person. But not recognizing what's in play for that person emotionally. And, you know, you're always getting feedback. And this is, you know, part of the critical thinking or the computer process of the brain that this kind of communication relates to, is that you're accepting feedback from the other person and you're immediately able to re-strategize based on that feedback. So for some reason, these conversations can spin out of control very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel, because I'm very confident in what I believe, that I'm usually the one who's maintaining composure. I don't raise my voice. I don't interrupt. The other person does usually 75% of the talking, just historically in these kinds of hostile interactions that I've had. But, you know, being able to see how they respond to something and then re-strategize based on that, maybe even turning direction completely, or ending the conversation if it's not going to go anywhere, or never having the conversation. And again, that goes back to, you know, your own sphere of control. Why am I doing this? Why am I here? What do I want out of this interaction?
Okay. See, I guess what I'm trying to get at is bottom line, do you think that abrasive communication that really does upset people has perhaps greater value than we might think it does? Because again, when people look at this, you know, you're being a jerk to me, and I'm going to shut down. I'm just not convinced that people are actually shutting down. I think they're certainly making a choice because they're unable to deal with what's going on. You know, you mentioned fight or flight, but I don't know if that's of zero value because I've exercised nonviolent communication with a lot of people who just don't care about what I'm trying to explain, and I sort of reflect on those instances and wonder what if I had instead tried to set them off and push some buttons, which may sound really awful, but I come back to the, you know, what if I had made that person have a think?
Yeah. Gosh, I don't know. I can only speak from what my history has been. And usually the problems that we have in our personal lives, I think, are from the absence, they result from the absence of a strategy, you know, or a methodology for solving a problem. Whether it be some emotional problem or an addiction or a tumultuous relationship. So, you know, I look at my own failures, and I can only speak for myself, and I never had the experience of, and I get what you're saying. It totally makes sense. But just from my own experience, I never look back at any of these interactions and say, gosh, if I had just been more hostile.
I kind of do.
That's just me. Yeah, so that's interesting. And let me really think about that. Like, is there a time where somebody was smart and they just were apathetic, and if I had leaned on them a little bit more, it could have kicked their, you know, their high-powered brain into gear. You know, the brain that works so well for thinking about other things, like maybe the person was a dentist, right? Mm-hmm. Like this was a situation that I had for years, right? An ex-girlfriend of mine, her dad was a dentist. And he was very conservative. And, you know, every conversation would end with him going, oh my goodness, you're totally right. I totally agree with you. So right. But then, you know, I would leave and he would go back to Fox News and his other conservative friends. And the next time I saw him, it was like we started again, you know?
Yeah.
And I talked to this girl, and we broke up years ago, but I talked to her around the time of the last election. And she said, my dad is going to pay me to vote for Mitt Romney. Huh. He's going to pay me $100 to vote for Mitt Romney. And I was like, well, what the hell? You know, that, so what that means, that's like saying to me, hey, Brett, do you know that you wasted 60 hours of your life with my dad? You know? And these are relationships. I mean, these are people that I still care about today. I mean, and still have good relationships with today. And that was hurtful because this was somebody who, at least in the moment, it felt like he was taking me seriously in a way that people who saw me in diapers probably will never take me seriously. You know? Because it's like, oh, yeah, I remember when, you know, you ate food off the kitchen floor, you know, so you're not a serious person. But somebody who sees me, who is introduced to me as a fully formed adult, like this man, is capable of seeing me as somebody who should be taken seriously. Now, this is a person who's not an idiot. His pants are on with the zipper in the front. He's a dentist, which means he is allowed to put, you know, power tools in people's mouths. And he's voting for Mitt Romney. And, like, why is there this disconnect? His mind is capable of grasping these ideas. And he would even say, yes, Brett, I totally agree with what you're saying. You're so right. So what happened? Now, maybe I could have leaned on him more. Maybe I should have tried to, like Fox News does, trigger more of an emotional response. But I feel like that's kind of cheating, right? To get people into an emotional state and then try to turn them in a different direction.
Okay, well hold on, because I don't think it's cheating. I think it's a consequence of illegitimate process in the past having already caused a negative effect. Like and this is why I constantly wonder about the value of abrasive communication. And you know, I even hate using the word abrasive because I'm focused on process. We talk about here at Ed and Ethan, we talk about from time to time why understanding the difference between pragmatism and process is important, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So pragmatism, you want to have specific needs met. You want to come up with specific solutions, but you have to also recognize that process is what allows you the freedom to do that most effectively. So if you have a controlled process via statism, right? So, you know, you allocate tax dollars to come up with a good solution or whatever. Probably not overtly effective. It might be very effective. Who knows? But the problem is you have a completely illegitimate process behind it. So chances are you're going to run into malinvestment problems of that nature. So when it comes to communication, what I typically wonder is what I'm saying wrong? Is it untruthful? Is it illogical? In respect to process, is it wrong? And typically, I come up with the answer, even if I'm swearing at somebody, it might be unpleasant, but I don't think it's wrong. And as long as it's not wrong, as long as I'm not saying, look, I think you believe in fairy tales and that you shouldn't be allowed to believe in fairy tales. If I say that, that's wrong. Because that's not respectful of legitimate philosophical process. If I say something like, I think you believe in fairy tales, and I respect your right to believe in fairy tales, though I don't respect your fairy tales at all, then that's different, right? And I don't see anything wrong with that, and I know it upsets some people. But again, I start to wonder if what I've said isn't specifically wrong, I don't know what's... Like I can't find fault with it.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's get away from, or just for the sake of this conversation, let's see where this takes us. Let's get away from the ideas of right doing and wrong doing, and let's flesh this out a little bit more. So, can you give me a specific example of an interaction? Who the other person was, what the topic was, and what happened?
Okay, actually, there is a very recent example.
FaceTubes?
Yeah, you know, well, I, you know, went on Facebook to vent a little bit because, shucks, it's fun sometimes. So I did run into a situation where somebody had posted the recording. I'm not sure if it was an actual recording or just voice acted, whatever. An atheist calling his mother to tell her he's an atheist, to insist upon the fact, even though to his mother it was devastating news. So... Somebody posted in response to this that essentially, look, loudmouth atheists should be more respectful of the people that they are around. For instance, to a mother, it is very important that her son be a Christian, and that shattering this perception would be harmful to her emotionally. To which I responded that, you know, this is, to me, no different than saying, look, if you tell a father that his athletic footballer son is gay and it's very important to him that his son is not gay, you know, it seems like a complete equivalency to me, and maintaining somebody's ignorance or rather maintaining the preservation of their sensibilities for the sake of their comfort didn't make logical sense to me. It seems like a logical inconsistency. So I guess, you know, relating it to a bigoted father might have been too abrasive, but I don't see anything mm-hmm. wrong with what I said.
Okay. So how long did this go on for?
Oh, God, I think it stretched out to about 150, 175 comments, something like that. Basically, look, here's what the fellow who I was getting into this with was essentially saying that, look, I come from a background in which you respect your elders. I teach that to my children, that you respect your elders. And then he conflated.
Not just 'cause, but also just 'cause.
And this was weird, right? So he conflated the issue of respecting one's elders with respecting elders who love and treat you with care. So I pointed out to him that he's conflating the two issues, that yes, it's great that you respect your mother, for instance, because she loved and cared for you, but I don't think that has anything to do with being an elder. I don't see, you know, but you're mushing the two ideas together but they don't make sense. So pointing out this logical inconsistency, and I resorted to the BS word, and I called it logical idiocy or illogical idiocy, a logical inconsistency, and that really offended him that I would use foul language and that I would call it idiotic. But again, I don't see what was wrong with what I was saying, and I don't think he was actually getting upset at my use of foul language. I think he was getting upset at the fact that I was pointing out that he was logically inconsistent. And this would go on throughout the thread until eventually he outright would say, I demand respect for my children. And I would reply, how do you demand something that you've earned? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he just refused to clarify again and again and again. And it was really upsetting until he eventually did resort himself to, you know, name calling and all that good stuff. It was a lot of fun. But again, I don't see what was wrong with anything I said.
All right. Well, yeah. And my solution would be a simple one. I don't know how this will go over with the people in the audience, but I would say, don't go on Facebook, right? That's the thing, right? Because we're talking about communication, and we're thinking that communication is something that we do to build a mutual understanding with people we care about, right? So Facebook is to communication. It's basically like they're as similar as, like, you go up to your friend and say, would you like to play chess with me? And your friend says, well, what if we just threw our feces at each other instead, right? They're not related in any way. You're not communicating with people on Facebook. And, you know, the example that I use on the show all the time is I used to drive like 600 miles a week in Massachusetts, right? People are flipping me off, honking their horn, mouthing swear words to me through their window. But, you know, if we came around the same corner at the supermarket and bumped carriages, that same person, I guarantee, would be like, oh, so sorry. I'm not saying they're meek or you know, they don't have any spine. I'm just saying that with the barriers like Facebook or 4,000-pound boxes of steel removed, people communicate much differently and much more compassionately and much more peacefully.
I've gotten into the shouting match thing with people either at a workplace or in other, you know, IRL situations, if you want to put it that way. I mean, you know, right here on Liberty Express, or I guess now just on Ed and Ethan, you know, we're communicating with thousands of people whom we don't know to posit our ideas. And I do look at Facebook as sort of the same thing. It's kind of like a random selection of individuals, you know, semi-random, with which I can interact at will, nearly. So I would agree with you that when situations are more personalized, generally people do start to communicate differently.
Yeah.
But when it is getting into that sort of randomly selected interactions with other individuals, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is it bad to piss them off? And I don't think I can't convince myself that it is.
Well, see, for me too, like, I got pissed, like, the whole reason I wouldn't say the whole reason, but one of the reasons I came to the ideas of liberty was because someone pissed me off in a conversation, and then I thought, like, whoa, you know, maybe I'm wrong, and I went on the internet to prove them wrong and then found out that I was wrong. But I have that desire to want to learn, too, in that sense. So pissing people off that don't have the desire to actually learn.
But isn't that part of that desire? Like, why would you be pissed off otherwise?
Yeah.
I don't know, Brett?
Well, let's say bad in terms of suboptimal for your goal, right? Like, so there's nothing, you know, bad about what you did. What you did was not illogical, right? It wasn't unethical. So, you know, to call it bad, but maybe it was suboptimal for whatever your goal was. Or whatever, you know, as far as addressing that other person's, you know, motivating factors were.
Right. That's responding to that pragmatic need for a solution to a problem, right? The idea that you need to communicate effectively.
Right.
I guess just from my perspective, what really matters is process. Like I get the desire to communicate effectively. We've actually talked about it between Ed and I and a former producer here. We were talking about the efficacy of communicating in soft tones, friendly terms, something that people unfamiliar with a message of liberty, for instance, could relate to and become informed by. And certainly there's value in that, but I don't know if that's really my goal. I wonder about that because I think my goal, but I don't even know, but I think my goal is essentially to explain what I'm thinking and why and leave it out there for people to judge whether or not it is logically consistent. And that's all I really care about. So I'm not even really sure what my optimal goal is.
That's a conversation one needs to have with oneself, whoever it is, because I had to do it, and I looked at the amount of time and energy I had invested in those types of interactions and the amount of anger that it had produced for me and for other people and the amount of discomfort that it had produced for bystanders.
Hmm.
And I said, gosh, I should really think about what I'm trying to do here. And the answer for me was, I think I wanted respect from people. I think, when I looked at, let's just talk about with family, right? Because that was a specific type of interaction where I believe I was harboring resentment, right? About things that had happened when I was younger. And I believed that the table had turned, right? Mm-hmm. Because these were, and we're not just talking about my parents, and I never have conversations like this with my mother, but the people who were adults when I was younger, and I've had conversations like this with my father for sure. Well, now I'm bigger. Now I realize I'm smarter, And I want to show that. And this was happening on a very subtle level. And we're going back years, right? Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to understand why I was trying to flex these muscles, right? But I think a lot of it too was about self-efficacy, and this need that I had to use unfortunately, people as like my own intellectual speed bag as a way to show a kind of superiority. And that's, that's uncomfortable stuff to look at, right? And there's a lot involved there, and I'm just kind of skimming across the surface of that. But what I found was there was a much deeper root cause for my behavior, because on the surface, it's very easy for me to say, well, gosh, I've got these great ideas and I've done this research and this is really the moral route and you're clearly very confused and I care about you and I want to help, but that's not why we're doing it.
Yeah.
For most of us. Maybe there are people and that is completely genuine, right? They're like, I'm very smart. You need some help. Here I am. You're welcome.
Right.
And it's that simple. But for me, it wasn't. So, I encourage people to do that because we might find that there's time and energy that can be reallocated or there's all of this emotional distress that we can spare ourselves if we're doing this full time. I mean, I see people who are like full time on Facebook fighting with others. And I don't understand how that feels good. like to get up in the morning and the first thing you do is go to Facebook and see who's dumb today is, I don't know. I just find that very unrewarding because it's an open loop you can never close, right?
Sure.
There's always going to be people on the internet who disagree with you or on Facebook specifically. And Facebook is unique. Well, it's not unique. I mean, it's a forum where there's lots of forums where people are fighting. But, any place where common threads are available to the average angry man with a keyboard, you see these kinds of interactions.
Hmm.
And, it's an open loop that you can never be closed. You can never be done. You can never win.
Right. And, right? And that's why I kind of take it in doses. Very small, very infrequent. Well, mostly infrequent doses. But I get, you know... I guess I've been thinking about this as you've been talking. I've been listening to what you're saying, and I've been thinking more about, you know, what is my personal perspective here and my goal. And I think of this as like putting an ounce of gold, a nugget, in front of somebody, and they have no idea why they should take it off the table. And I'm going to explain to them exactly why it's there, exactly why they should take it, why it would benefit them, and what makes it so cool. And if they want to pick it up, they can. If they don't pick it up, they can steam off and think about why they should pick it up and why I might have been right or why I'm disastrously wrong, whatever the case. But I guess I'm not out to convince anybody of anything. I am out to simply explain my views because I think they are so often not well explained. And I'm not saying that there are, you know, I'm not trying to eschew other people who are out in the liberty community explaining their views. In fact, what I am saying is we need more people like that out
there.
Yeah,
man.
But what I'm running into here is that I don't think it's my responsibility for other people to see value. It is only my responsibility to express value and to show it to people. And if they don't pick it up for themselves, you know, like we get stuck on this idea, like, how do I get people to understand? How do I get people to? It's kind of like the same thing as if you look at education and you say, how do I get people to be educated really well? How do I get people to understand mathematics, science, English language, literature, whatever? How do I get people to understand these topics? When instead, shouldn't we be saying, look, you know, why would you be interested in these topics? I want to put these topics out there. This is why they're important to me. Maybe they'll be important to you for the same reason, whatever. I really want people to find their own value because I think that that's probably the best way to do it. And not even because it's the best way to do it, just because I don't see any philosophically consistent reason for wanting people specifically to understand my own solutions to problems, rather I just want them to understand philosophically what's going on.
What I want is I just want people to understand the message of liberty and what is the best way to achieve that, I guess.
That's a pragmatic thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm fine with that.
Well, yeah, I guess it's not wrong. I guess my perspective is slightly different there.
No, I understand what you're saying, and I think that applies to what I do as well, because, you know, when I tell just an ordinary person, you know, church-going taxpayer, voter, just people who do the things that they're supposed to do, what I do, you know, and they try to wrap their head around school sucks project, you know, and they... So what are you trying to, you think you're going to change the world or reform education? And I don't think I'm going to do either of those things, you know, because that's setting myself up, setting up expectations that are unrealistic for one man with my resources. Right. But what I do think I can do is I can package up my body of knowledge and experience, and I can make it available to anyone who wants it, you know, and maybe that will only be a few thousand people. Or maybe ultimately it will be a few million people. And it's not like I'm trying to change a system. It's like I'm trying to provide people who want it strategies to free themselves from that system as much as possible. And I think what you're saying is very similar. And I think we're in agreement. And I do think that it is important to communicate these ideas to as many people as possible. And that was part of the attraction of the NVC, because when you look at how obvious this philosophy is, you say, okay, well, have enough people not heard about it, or was it communicated poorly? You know, because these are ideas, at least as far as like some penetration into the mainstream. This is a philosophy that has, I mean, if you want to go back to, you know, the 50s with Rand in America, or the 70s with the kind of birth of the libertarian movement, There has been some penetration, but it never really took off. Now, you could say it was because, well, the state controls education, the state heavily influences, if not controls, the media. Most people are obedient yes men, and they're going to do what they're told to serve the status quo and the powers that be, and that's just how the world's going to work. But things, you know, I was talking, we had Jeffrey Tucker on the show last night, and he's such a positive guy. And
Isn't he? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm dumping my cynicism on him. I'm like, you know, Jeffrey, sometimes this is what I think. Help me with, you know, and he he's just so optimistic that he made me realize that if I reflect back on the last 5 years and what I've been able to do and the amount of people that I've been able to reach with one message through one channel, as one man, and then look at everybody who is doing similar things like Free Talk Live, look what Stefan Molyneux has done in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've pushed people away, you know, and we've made people angry, but we've also connected and what we're doing and what we're projecting is having an impact, and more people are doing it, and it's becoming easier and easier to do. And, you know, the state is kind of, at this point anyway, helping. They're like, we're really bad. Look, we're showing you. We're putting it on TV. We're the worst. You know, but we get, you know, here's the thing that we do to serve ourselves. We've got flying killer robots, and money printing machines. But here's something we do to serve you, right? Health insurance. It sucks. It's terrible. But our flying robot program that's good for us is awesome. So they're putting it right in people's faces for anyone who wants to see it. And I've had this conspiracy theory that they are really like messing with people who are kind of awake for a long time, basically saying, watch what we can get people to believe.
Right?
Like it's this like subtle war they're having with Alex Jones, right? Like we're going to say we killed Osama bin Laden. We're going to give people no evidence. We're going to show them nothing. We're going to tell a ridiculous story about what we did at the most tumultuous time in Barack Obama's presidency. And everyone is going to believe it. And all we have to do is say it.
Hmm.
No one will ask for evidence. All we have to do is say it, and everyone will believe it. So that's just so you know, Alex Jones, and all your, somewhat awake or conspiracy-oriented people, just so you know where you stand with the American people, we can tell them anything, and they'll believe it.
Yeah, the sad part is I wouldn't really be surprised.
Yeah, me neither.
but the thing is, too, is that concern, and it's like kind of, I'm half tongue-in-cheek, but that's even dissipating for me, because I see that new people are coming in all the time. And even, you know, I was listening to like conservative talk radio driving in the car yesterday, and they're even like, well, they're really good at this language when they're out of power. We'll see how they do when they get in power. But more of the things that I would only ever hear on Free Talk Live in 2006, 2007, are penetrating the mainstream conversation now. And it's not just on conservative issues. I was listening to some conservative station, and they're talking about the merits of marijuana legalization. So it appears that there is, and hopefully I'm not being too selective in my observations, there is a shift happening. And, I don't think the state is going to go down without a fight. Mm-hmm. And they look like they're gearing up for their fight in a lot of ways. But I have to say that I'm very, very encouraged.
Yeah. I think we have the tool, like technology is going to allow us to be free, essentially. With Bitcoin, with money, when we take the power away of the state having control of money, that that's the beginning of the end type of thing. And in the long haul, in the long game, peaceful parenting and raising non-statist children is what is really going to change the world, I think. And as long as, you know, we just need to get a critical mass and get those ideas out there, and then it'll just kind of like, you know, I'm so optimistic that I think we might even be able to achieve a free society in our lifetimes. Honestly.
What is it that I always say about the general idea? The market
always wins, yes.
Whether you want it to or not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's basically what happens with... I don't think, Brett, that your observations are incorrect. I think they're fairly spot on. Yep. Is that, yeah, I've seen the same thing. A lot of these things that are penetrating mainstream discussion that you would never have heard before are becoming more and more normal. I saw it here in the province of Saskatchewan and in Kanuckistan here. I saw the... When we formed the Saskatchewan Marijuana Party... It started out, we had one of the members of our executive council, an austere body, but we had one of the members of our executive council. He wrote a letter to the editor condemning the illegality of marijuana and talking about the merits of legalizing. All of his coworkers at that time said, "You're going to get arrested. You're going to go to jail because you wrote that stupid letter." Of course, nothing happened. And as that went forward, people became more and more comfortable talking about this idea, which was previously so outside of the mainstream. Mm-hmm, so now I see the same thing happening in general. I mean, that is a liberty discussion. But in general terms, liberty discussions are happening more and more.
I saw this. I don't know where it was. I think it was a fairly mainstream publication, but it was talking about one of the top 10 things of 2013 was the rise of libertarianism. I can't remember what the source was, but I thought it was a fairly... I was like kind of surprised. I was like, whoa. So we're making headway in that sense.
If it was from Slate, it was probably accompanied by a picture of Godzilla. All right. So hey, listen, Brett, I really do appreciate the time you've given us. Do you have any parting thoughts for us? Because we should probably wrap this up now.
Sure. Well, just to go back to something you said a minute ago, which also rolls back to the beginning of our conversation, the state fights a war on all fronts. Right, the state is, and this is a project that has gone on for more than a century, and you know, goes back to the Prussian idea. Or it's not a Prussian idea, but an idea that the Prussians embraced of Fabianism, right? Which is basically a war of attrition, a war on as many fronts as possible to defeat your enemy. So the state comes at people, and you know, to understand the perspective of a small ruling class trying to control hundreds of millions of people. Yeah, it makes sense. And it might be very scary some days to be like, wow, there's 5,000 of us. You know, I'm talking about like real decision makers in the world, maybe less, I don't know, saying, gosh, there's 3 million of these idiots out there. And, you know, there's that many guns on this landmass. My goodness, this is terrifying. What are we going to do? But they fight a war on all fronts. And I wouldn't say that we should fight a war on all fronts, but we should seek a peaceful world on as many fronts as possible. And the path that I've chosen is the education versus schooling path. But I agree that the peaceful parenting thing is incredibly valuable. I agree that maybe some of the short-term, you know, alternative currency ambitions is also has a lot of merit. I mean, I have a lot of questions. There's a lot of things I don't understand. About Bitcoin, questions that I would want to get answered. But I'm encouraged by... the possibility for that technology to exist. I accept Bitcoins. I am thinking about, you know, purchasing Bitcoins on a monthly basis. I've certainly taken donations in Bitcoin. Cool. So I'm supportive of it at this point. I'm interested to see what develops in that market in the next 5 years. But you're right, that's more of a short-term thing. Some of the things people are doing to raise questions about the state, more of a short-term thing. The peaceful parenting is a long-term thing. So we have the talent and the resources and the emotional investment to seek a peaceful world on numerous fronts. And I have been somewhat critical in the past of like, oh, you know, you shouldn't do that. That's bad. You know, you shouldn't stand in front of cop cars. But that's what's important to that person. If that's, you know, their hierarchy of values, you know, that can be their division of labor. And, you know, I'm very encouraged by what I see, and I think that multiple fronts for seeking a peaceful world is very important. And it's a small number of people who are doing it, but it's a small number of people who ever do anything and create significant change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely true. Brett, thanks again. I really do appreciate it. How can people find you for those who have lasted through this this lengthy but fantastic discussion?
Sure. First of all, as I gather all my plugs, I'm going to repost this on my feed. So can you guys give your website?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's www.edandethan.com.
Excellent. All right. My website is schoolsocksproject.com. We have a YouTube channel. Our username is School Sucks Podcast, and I hope people will go and check out our video series, The Best of John Taylor Gatto, which is me turning parts of Gatto's book, The Underground History of American Education, into hopefully a flashy and entertaining video.
Yeah, they are good. I've listened to them. They're really
great. Another thing to add to my list of things to watch and listen to. Fantastic.
We'll watch it after. Me and Ethan will watch it again. I've watched it. We'll watch it again.
We've got plans now. All right. Thanks a bunch, Brett.
Thank you so much.
For sure. We'll talk again.